Welcome to this special video edition of House Calls for Healthcare Professionals. I'm Dr. Bill Krauts, Senior Director of Worldwide Health for the Microsoft Corporation in Redmond, Washington. And today we're back at Microsoft Research for part two of a program that's taking a look at some of the projects, some of the things going on here at Microsoft that in one way or another are related to healthcare and healthcare applications down the line. Let's take a look at first at some really exciting work that's being done by Dr. David Heckerman and Jonathan Carlson that helps us visualize HIV and the AIDS virus. David, how are you?
Bill,
good to see you.
Nice to meet you.
Jonathan, nice to meet you. Hey, thanks for joining us today. So let's kick off our program with what I think is going to be a really interesting discussion about some of your pioneering work in visualizing the AIDS virus.
Yeah, we are working to build a vaccine for HIV. And your folks should probably know that to build an HIV vaccine, you need to stimulate the immune system, train it to recognize certain bits of bad pathogens and eliminate those pathogens from the body. There's two arms of the adaptive immune system. There's the humoral arm and the cellular arm. We're working on a cellular vaccine. And so there what we want to do is identify cellular epitopes that our immune system can recognize, epitopes inside of HIV. And to do that, we look at how HIV mutates in individuals. We all have different immune systems, different HLA types. And if the cellular arm of the immune system is affecting HIV, we should be able to see how HIV responds to different immune system types by correlating the person's immune system type, their HLA type, with the mutations in HIV that you see. And Jonathan Carlson can show you a program that does just that.
Okay, and before we do that, I'd like to point out that David Heckerman is Dr. Heckerman. He is actually a physician who works here at Microsoft Research. And what I think is interesting is your work along this line actually came out of some other work that you were doing that had to do with, as I recall, search or something else.
I think you're probably referring to our spam filtering work. The similarity there is more of a metaphor. The idea is that spammers react to our spam filters, they change, they adapt, and so we had to build software that could handle that. And in the same way, HIV adapts to the immune system attacks HIV, HIV mutates to avoid the immune system, and so we're using some of these same very general ideas to apply it to the HIV space.
Terrific. Okay, Jonathan, show us what you got.
Yeah, so the goal of this program is to try and identify patterns within the HIV DNA sequence that correlate with the specific HLA molecules that patients have. So as David mentioned, we're looking at the cellular arm of the immune response, and that's really restricted by the HLA proteins. So the idea is that patients who have the same HLA protein, for example, B57, will tend to target the same stretches of HIV DNA. And so the patients that have HIV who also have B57 will tend to see mutations within these epitopes. So what we have here is a visualization of some of what we've found. And I've drawn here one of the HIV proteins, GAG, which goes around here in counterclockwise order. And what I have on the outside of the circle here are the correlations that we've found between these HLA epitopes. For example, we see at position 12 here that people with A74, C06, C02, or A30, which are all HLA alleles, those people tend to have mutations right at that position. Now, one of the interesting HLA alleles is B57, which evidence shows people who have B57 tend to be very effective at fighting HIV. So this is an HLA allele of interest. We can see here that patients who have B57 tend to target this region right here. See, we can zoom in on this. So here we see what happens when a patient has B57, they tend to have a mutation right here. Now, as you know, proteins are folded into three-dimensional structures, so mutations don't happen independently. When you have a mutation on one spot, that could destabilize the protein structure, for example. And so another aspect of this work is to try and understand what further constraints there are on HIV evolution. So for example, when HIV mutates in response to B57 at this position 242, are there other mutations that happen at the same time? So what this shows here is that when HIV mutates right here, we'll also see mutations around position 210, 180, 160, and so forth.
So basically, we've gone from algorithms that help us fight spam to algorithms that might one day uncover a vaccine for HIV.
Right, so it's all about finding patterns and trying to understand through a vast amount of data what consistent patterns do you see within that data, what correlations do you see, how are things adapting and responding.
And David, have there been any big sort of aha moments here as you've gone through this?
Yeah, one thing we found, one thing we a new aspect of HIV that we think we've uncovered with these sorts of tools is the notion or the distinction between what are called good epitopes and what are called decoy or bad epitopes. What should happen when the immune system attacks HIV is HIV needs to mutate to avoid the attack, and then it should become ill, you know, weaker, less fit. And that's what we call a good epitope. But with a decoy epitope, the immune system attacks HIV, then HIV mutates, and it doesn't lose any fitness. And so now the immune system has wasted its effort in attacking these epitopes, and it's done no good. So with tools like this, we're starting to tease out which epitopes are good and which epitopes are bad, and that seems to be a new breakthrough in HIV vaccine design. And if we can take just the good epitopes and put those in a vaccine and remove any bad epitopes from the vaccine, we think we have a good chance.
Well, David, congratulations on your really terrific work. Jonathan,
thanks
for joining us.
Thank you.
And so we've been looking today, or started to look at, the ways that we are visualize information on a computer. I'm going to take you down the hall to meet George Robertson, who's doing some very good work in graphs and charts and the way we visualize those. So come with me. So that was pretty cool stuff going on with Dr. David Heckerman and his team. Now let's take a look at another project called DynaViz. I'm going to introduce you to a guy named George Robertson. George, hi. Hey, thanks for giving us a few moments today. Tell me about DynaViz.
Well, DynaViz is a visualization platform that we've been working on for a couple of years now that's designed to help a in the first version, to help a business person understand the data that they're working with. And you could think of this first version as a business charting package that has a number of new important features added to it. One of them is that we do animation everywhere to help the user stay in context. So if you're looking at either business data or maybe in your context it might be patient data or something like that, and you are doing a transition from one patient to another or one chart to another, we use animation to help you stay in context and understand the changes that are happening to the data that's being displayed.
Okay, let's take it for a spin.
Okay. So we're looking at one particular series of data right now in a bar chart, and let me just walk through some examples of what I mean by the animated changes. We've done a series of studies that make it clear to us that doing these animated transitions do, in fact, help you to do your work more effectively because you stay in context. And in the case of where a range is changing as well as the data values, it's important to do a two-stage animation where, in this case, we changed the range first because it was getting larger, and then we changed the data values. Now, if I add another series to this, the series will grow in place next to the existing series. If I do a sorting operation, like sort on the return rate here, I see an animated sort. And notice there's something subtle about what we're doing here. When I do a reverse sort, if I did the obvious kind of animation, those items would pass in front of each other simultaneously, and you'd lose track of it. So we're actually doing a staggered animation, and you see by staggering the animation slightly, you can't lose track of what you're looking at. So the other thing is that if I change to a different view, for example, a stack bar chart, you want to see an animated transition of that, or even a 3D view, 3D stacked, or the 3D bar chart. Basically, any transition between views or even between chart types is animated. So if I go to a line chart, you see an animated transition, or an area chart, or a plateau chart, or even a pie chart. So we have some underlying technology here that does morphing of chart objects and changing their shapes during the animation so that you can track the individual items that you're focusing on and keep track of them.
And of course, I know my House Calls viewers are thinking, well, what in the world does this have to do with healthcare? But in fact, this can be any kind of data. I mean, we're looking at business data, but it could be clinical data. It could be glucose values over time, or it could be any other kind of clinical parameter, and making that sort of more obvious, more intuitive, more fun to look at.
That's right. Yes, this is very generic, both in terms of the kinds of visualizations. I'm showing you some basic charting capabilities, but we've designed this framework so we can add some more complex visual representations as well. But as you say, it can be used on any data.
And you have some evidence that doing these kinds of animations in the way that you're doing actually helps people either understand what they're looking at or allows them to pay closer attention to the data.
Yes, we've done a number of studies, and we know that with most of these transitions are timed to be between a half a second and 1 second, and we've studied the length of time that is kind of optimal for these kind of transitions. And we know that with one of these transition animations, users are able to perform their tasks faster, actually, than without the animation, because they stay in context, they understand what they're looking at, they don't have to think about the data that, you know, the new view and what it actually means.
So who knows, maybe someday coming to an electronic medical record system or hospital information system near you. George, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And let's move on to the next project. We're almost at the end of this special two-part edition of House Calls for Healthcare Professionals. And last but not least, I'm going to show you yet another really interesting way that humans will one day, soon, be interacting with computers. We're going to look at the research that's being done by a guy named Desney Tan, one of the brilliant researchers here at Microsoft Research, and his assistant, who's going to meet with us, Scott Saponis. Take a look. Hi, Scott.
Hey.
How are you?
Good.
Well, as I was mentioning outside, this is work that's been pioneered by Desney Tan, one of the researchers here at Microsoft Research. You've been working with them the past, several months now, right?
Yep.
Okay. And you're going to show us this way that we will interact with our computer using muscles, right?
Yeah, that's right. So traditionally with computer interfaces, we usually use physical transducers, things like buttons and keyboards and mice and stuff like that to interact with the computer, some kind of device right underneath our fingers. What we're looking at here is how we can interact directly using the muscles as an interface so that you might be able to interact with the computer without anything in your hands or while your hands are already busy using one of the other tools that we already use in our everyday lives.
So explain to me first this hardware that you're connected to.
Sure. So this is a prototype of a future system that we'd like to do where we have sensors on our arm. So they're just attached to the surface of our skin where we're trying to sense the electrical signal associated with muscle activation that comes from something in our nervous system called motor neurons. And so the idea is what we can try to do is detect and decode those neurological signals at the surface of the skin and use that to try and control the computer.
All right, and let's take a look at the screen now and show me how basically what you do is you kind of train the computer to recognize the electrical signals coming from muscle.
That's right. So it's a really complex set of muscles. Our hands are really complex units. But what we can do is use something called machine learning to try and interpret and understand that signal. So over here on the screen, you can see some of this signal coming from my arm. And as I make a fist or move my fingers around, you see all these different colors changing. And that's all the complex signal that we're sensing from the skin. And what we can do is the computer can present me with a series of things to do with my fingers to try and learn what's going on. So as this computer tells me different fingers to lift off the surface of the computer, off the desk, I'm going to lift my fingers, just following the pattern that a computer asked me to do. And meanwhile, what it's doing is trying to build a model of how my finger, of what the signal has to do with how my finger works. And then when I tell it to start classifying, it's going to try and classify what my finger's doing just from that signal. Now, we only gave it a couple of seconds of training there, so it's not as good as it could be. But you can see it's kind of being able to interpret what my fingers are doing.
So, Scott, let's talk a little bit about some of the implications for this. I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind is in the realm of accessible computing or assistive technology.
Yeah, so a lot of work has been done looking at how you can use the muscle signals to interact with a computer or control a wheelchair or something like that for somebody who maybe has some physical impairments. And so there's definitely some opportunities there, looking at places where there may be some muscles or motor neurons left that work, but where you don't have enough to be able to control your hands or fingers. You might be able to use that signal to interact with the computer directly.
I'm also even thinking that work scenarios where one can't interact with the keyboard or touch a screen, surgery comes to mind, for example, surgeons who are gowned and gloved, that perhaps this might be a way that one day they might be interacting with the computer.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the hospital or in the lab, you're in a situation where maybe you're wearing gloves and they have something on them, blood or whatnot, and you don't want to spread that around keyboard to keyboard, but you still need to do some kind of data entry. This might give you a way to interact with the computer without actually touching any of those physical devices and spreading those germs around.
All right. And I should mention that Scott here probably started college when he was about 10. So don't be put off by that. Hey, Scott, thanks so much. I'll touch your electrified hand there. Thanks so much for joining us on House Calls. Really appreciate it. Great work. And send my my good thoughts to Desney Tan as well. And thank you for joining us on this special video edition of House Calls for Healthcare Professionals. Until next time, for all of us here at Microsoft, I'm Dr. Bill Krauts. Thanks for watching.